My name is Bronson Fry, and I'm here with Roger Hickel. We are recording a legacy podcast with the Alaska Associated General Contractors. Good morning, Roger. How are you doing today?
Great. Good morning, Bronson. Thanks for inviting me. This is kind of exciting for me. First time.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. Looking forward to getting to know you a little bit and getting to know your story and your history. And so we might as well just jump right in. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and what your background is, and then we'll see how you got yourself into Alaska, into the construction industry, and we'll kind of go from there.
Great. Well, my name's Roger Hickel, and a lot of people think that I was born and raised in Alaska because of my Uncle Wally, who's famous, and my Uncle Vern, who are longtime Alaskans. And like I said, they're my uncles, and I really didn't know them or throughout my lifetime. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas. My dad worked for Boeing. My dad grew up on a farm with 10 other siblings, Wally and Vern being his brothers. And my dad was in between Wally and Vern, and then there are a few other sisters. And my mom grew up on a farm in Kansas and with 10 siblings. And so I tell people I have over 120 first cousins.
Wow.
And they have a hard time believing that, you know, that you could have so many first cousins. But a lot of people know my Uncle Vern, who raised his family here in Anchorage, and he had 17 children. So,
oh man,
you know, there's 17 of 120 right there from one uncle.
Wow.
And so, you know, with my mom and dad growing up on the farm, I kind of, you know, they had the good farm work ethic and knew a lot about, you know, just how to figure shit out and get it done.
Yeah.
And so my dad, after he served in the Korean War, he went to work for Boeing. And in Wichita, Kansas, there's a big Boeing plant there.
Gotcha.
Wichita was called the air capital of the world at the time because it had Boeing, Learjet, McDonnell Douglas, Cessna, Beech. And so there are a lot of aircraft companies in Wichita, which is right in the middle of the buckle of the Bible Belt. So mm-hmm. I grew up with a very strict upbringing.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that.
And had five brothers. And so my dad had, you know, he had a tough time supporting the family on a Boeing machinist income. Mm-hmm. And so what he liked to do was he was a very good carpenter and builder, and so he always had a side project going. And so me and my five brothers, we were his workforce, you know.
Of course.
He was always, you know, buying a duplex and then remodeling it and selling it or taking on side jobs. And so that's first how I first kind of got into construction. Some of my brothers hated it, and I enjoyed, you know, working with my dad on the other end of a table saw or helping him. And so I kind of grew up doing that type of work and enjoyed it. And then I went to high school at high school and grade school at a Catholic parochial school.
Oh, wow.
And the high school I went to was an all-boys high school, very disciplined education.
Mm-hmm.
And so after my senior year of high school, I was trying to find a place to go to college. My parents couldn't afford it, so I needed to get a scholarship. And I was good in sports. I wanted a basketball scholarship, but I couldn't land a Division I school. So my senior year, I decided I'm going to go out for track.
All right.
And I went out for track. Got third in the state of Kansas in the half mile.
Wow.
And got a track scholarship to Wichita State, which is right there. Because I was just as, you know, only had 1 year, there weren't very many other schools that even knew about me.
Right.
So I got a track scholarship for Wichita State. That's how I was able to go to college. And back then, you know, I knew I was interested in construction, but there were no construction management degrees. There's only a few colleges in the state that, or in the country, that had construction management. So I ended up getting a degree in business administration. And after my, I'll back up a minute, after my freshman year, well, I'll even back up 1 year before that, when I graduated from high school, my dad got transferred to Seattle.
Oh, okay.
So I graduated from high school, spent the summer in Seattle. My dad was still with Boeing. And I worked on a golf course putting in irrigation pipe for a brand new golf course. And I was in the trench putting pipe together and water up to my knees. I was cold and miserable that whole summer. And I says, there's no way I'm going to live in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle.
Right.
And on this crew, I met a couple of guys, and they said, hey, let's go to Alaska next summer and work on a fishing boat. We can make tons of money.
Oh, yeah.
And so I said, that's great. I go back to Wichita, Kansas for my freshman year of college.
Gotcha.
And scholarship was just books and tuition, so I had to still pay for my room and board, which is the most expensive part.
Right.
And so I ran out of my life savings after my freshman year of college, and so towards the end of my freshman year, I contacted those guys in Seattle and said, hey, we still good to go? The guy had contacts on a
right.
fishing boat. And he says, well, you know, I'm not sure if I want to go. I hear it's really, you know, tough work, risky work.
Cold.
And so I didn't even know my uncle Wally or Vern. And at the time, my uncle Wally was in D.C. He had just interrupted his governor term and went to D.C. to be Secretary of Interior under Nixon.
Interesting.
So I called my uncle Vern, and I said, hey, Vern, this is your nephew Roger in Kansas.
Who?
Yeah. And, no, he and my dad were fairly close, so he knew who I was. And And I said, hey, I had this job to work on a fishing boat, I thought, and it fell through, but I want to come to Alaska and see it and work in Alaska. And he knew that, you know, I hadn't been more than 100 miles from Wichita, Kansas. He knew how our family grew up. And he said, well, I'll get back to you. Let me see what I can do. And so I was prepared to go.
Yeah.
And so he calls me back a few weeks later and says, okay, I want you to be in Alaska right after you get out of school, first week in May.
Mm-hmm.
Beat all the other college kids up here.
Right.
And I want you to go over on McGraw Street to this company called Taps, and I want you to see a guy named, and I still remember his name, George Lipson. And you go in there, and you tell him your work hard and all summer, and I said, great. So I get up here, go over there, didn't even know what Taps was.
Right.
You know, and I got a job working as a surveyor assistant on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Wow.
A three-man crew, surveyor, engineer, and I was their head laborer.
When was this then?
What? In 1969.
69, okay.
Yeah. And I was 18 years old.
Wow.
And I remember my salary. It was $700 for the month.
Oh, man.
And I thought that was great.
Right.
Plus, you know, they paid for my room and board.
Even better.
Yeah. And, you know, at the time, I could stay in Wichita and probably make about 40 cents an hour, maybe 75 cents if I got a good job. And so I saw the state of Alaska from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez that summer by helicopter, small aircraft, did river crossings, fell in love with the state.
I'll bet. What an adventure.
Yeah, it was like a paid camping trip. You
of
know,
course.
For the summer.
Wow.
And so that's how I got to Alaska. And then at the end of that summer, I learned about construction unions.
Oh, interesting.
And found out that I was the most underpaid labor in the state.
It gets even better?
At those wages. So before I left to go back to school in Kansas, I signed up at the Fairbanks local laborers union.
Nice.
Paid my dues, got signed up, paid all winter long, and I said, I'll be back next summer.
Nice.
And I want to work construction.
Yeah.
And back then, there was no apprenticeship program or anything for the laborers. You just showed up, and if you could work hard, you got the job.
Right. Cool.
You know, in boom times back back in, so that was 1970. So 1970, I got back to Fairbanks. One of the first, you know, because of our college semester, I could beat all the other college kids that were coming up
nice.
Here and working.
Cool.
During the summer.
Smart.
So I got on a great job, you know, they said, well, we'll obviously dispatch you to the Travelers Inn. You know, your last name's Hickel.
Right.
Hickel Construction's building it, but I actually worked for Ball Construction.
Okay.
Which was out of Seattle. They were a subcontractor to Hickel Construction.
Gotcha.
Which is my Uncle Vern. So I worked on the Travelers Inn as a laborer that whole summer, operating a jackhammer for most of the summer because it was a concrete tilled-up building, and we did a lot of drilling and chipping. And after that summer, I got to know the Ball Construction people, the superintendent and the project manager, and said, you know, I don't want to work in Fairbanks next year. There are no nightlife, no women,
right.
You know, all men, and right. working 60 hours a week. I just had no fun, and here I am 20 years old.
Right.
You know, I need some balance in my life.
It's still like that, by the way. No,
yeah.
Just kidding.
I am. And so...
just joking.
I went
Fairbanks
back to
awesome.
Wichita, and, oh, I lived like a king, you know. I bought my first car, a VW Bug, 1969 VW Bug, and paid half down on it and said, you know, I'm going back to Alaska the next summer and I'll pay off the other half next summer. And it's funny, I still have the note on that VW Bug.
Oh, man, awesome.
I paid $1,800 for the car, brand new, and put $900 down from my savings from working in Alaska that summer, and signed a note, which my dad had to co-sign, and it was a 3% interest rate and no other fees.
Wow.
So the car loan was for $900. I'd put $900 down. And so the next summer, after working in Alaska, I paid that car off. $927, you know.
Right.
The interest was $27.
What a deal.
What a deal. And I had the use of the car for the whole time.
Yeah, very nice.
And then and the reason why I bring that up is because I drove that VW Bug from Wichita, Kansas to Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow. I was going to ask you if you drove it.
4,000 miles.
Jeez.
Back and forth 7 times.
Whoa. Wow.
Up and back, so a total of 7 times.
My goodness.
And at the time, the Alcan Highway was 1,100 miles of gravel.
I was about to tell you, say that was dirt road at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Jeez.
1,100 miles of gravel. But I would, after my last final, I would jump in that VW Bug.
Man.
And it'd take about 7 days to drive to Anchorage.
You just camp on the way and just pull over somewhere? And
just camp. I had, you know, camping gear.
Sure.
And cooler and a Chevron credit card. Because usually I'd run out of money. And so I'd use that. That's the only credit card I have, is the Chevron credit card, to buy gas all the way up. And by the time the bill came through, you know, because it was through Canada and all that, I wouldn't get this Chevron bill for all those until like July. So I've been working the month.
What a guy! What a plan!
Yeah. So
gotta figure it out, man.
And so then I worked for Ball Construction as a laborer. Well, no, I started out with John Wayne Construction, which is curb and gutter company.
Okay.
That first summer in Anchorage, and I did curb and gutter work the whole summer. That was a tough job, and working with the Velardis, which were all of Spanish descent, they worked hard, and then Ball Construction wanted to expand. They were based out of Seattle in Alaska, and so it was Ball Velarde Construction. He partnered up with John Wayne, and so it was Ball Velarde for a couple of years, and that's who I worked for as a laborer, and then later as a labor foreman. And then after I graduated from college, I told Gary Ball, who was running Ball Velarde, I said, you know, this labor's work is tough. I would like to get into project management and work in the office. And so I worked my way up through Ball Construction. After I got out of college, I worked as an assistant project manager. One of my first jobs as assistant project manager was the Anchorage Business Park, where the cattle company is and all all those little buildings. So I worked as a project manager assistant under an experienced project manager. And then the next year, things were booming so much, you know, I was just forced into having more and more responsibility. So I became a project manager the next year. On my first building as a project manager was, I'm not even sure if it's still called, it might be Speedy Glass now, but it was Arctic Glass at Arctic Boulevard and Fireweed.
Yeah, I know the building.
That was my first job as a project manager. And then about a month later, I got another job out at the airport. It was called Van Dusen Air. It was the building right there on the end of the airport where back where Flying Tigers wasn't built yet. But that was a hangar and a refueling place for aircraft, and that was a concrete tilt-up building, which I'd learned a lot about as a laborer. And so those two jobs were my first jobs as project manager. And then I also like to say that you know you've been in the business too long when some of your first projects where you were project manager, they've torn down.
Right. They've gone up and come back down.
That one's been torn down. Cottonwood Creek Mall in Wasilla.
Right, yeah.
That was one of my projects. That was torn down. Flying Tigers were at the end of International Airport Road. Mm-hmm. That was one of my projects. They've torn that one down, and I can go on a few more.
Full circle.
Yeah.
No. So where are we now? We're in the mid-70s then? You're probably mid-20s or late 20s by now?
I was born in 50.
Okay.
And so this was about 1974.
Okay, okay.
It was when I got my first job as a project manager.
Gotcha. So you were moving right along. You got into the trade up here, doing vertical construction, early 20s. From farming to surveying, running a jackhammer on concrete, doing curbs and gutters, I guess more concrete work, and then right into the tilt-ups and then project managing shortly thereafter.
Yeah, and I didn't grow up on a farm. My mom and my dad grew up on farms, but they were smart enough. They wanted to get out of farming.
Oh, gotcha.
So I grew up in the city.
Okay.
In Wichita.
And your dad was a machinist then.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
He worked for Boeing, and so he couldn't wait to get off the farm either.
Gotcha.
And the youngest brother in my dad's family ended up with a family farm.
I see.
And same way in my mom's family. That was kind of the German tradition.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And yeah. So that's how that transpired. And then getting back to being a laborer, so when I went into the office as a project management assistant, I had already had about 6 years in the laborers union in local 941 out of Fairbanks, mm-hmm. and then I transferred to the Anchorage local. And so I was, when I approached Gary Ball about moving into the office, I had already sensed that I'd be taking a cut in pay. And so I told Gary that I wanted to stay in the laborers union, that I wanted to stay in the laborers union and get vested. It took 10 years to get vested.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I didn't want to throw away all that money that had been put into my pension and everything else. So he said, yeah, that'll work for him. So I worked in the office, but I was still through the laborers union until I got vested. And, you know, that was an advantage for me because I was able to keep my high labor salary over being a project manager or a project engineer because they weren't making as much
right.
at the time.
Right.
Yeah, especially across the, you know, the lower 48.
Oh, yeah.
And so I stayed in the union until I got vested, and then I went on to, you know, salary and management.
Right. Smart.
But I wanted to throw that in there because when I turned 62, I started receiving my laborer's pension.
Nice. Good for you.
Yeah.
I like hearing these success stories.
Yeah.
That's good.
And so, you know, growing up in the Midwest, you know, which was, you know, more of a right to work state, like a lot of places. But as an early age, I really appreciated unions and what they did for the workers, and so I've been pro union ever since I grew up because
that's cool
of their apprenticeship programs and what they do for the workers.
Right.
So a lot of people think the owner of a construction company isn't a vested laborer.
I like that.
And receiving a pension from
right
them.
Well, it's cool you can have a perspective like that. You know, having gone through it yourself, you kind of see the benefits.
Yeah.
And now receiving the benefits, even better.
Yeah. And so then I was with Ball Construction. It started out as Ball Bilardi, and then after a couple of years, they parted ways on the partnership, and then it was just Ball Construction and Engineering. And that's how it was kept separate from Ball Construction in Seattle, which was a large regional company.
Gotcha.
And then when Ball Construction in Seattle, they kind of said, well, we don't like that Alaska division. And so Gary Ball took the Alaska division and called it Ball Construction and Engineering. So it was solely an Alaska company. Ball Construction in Seattle was its own entity, and then they sold out, you know, when Gary's Ball's dad retired, they sold out to Skanska.
Interesting.
And they're still in existence there. You know, Skanska's, a French company, and so,
gotcha.
You know, now that's has grown to be a very large company, and then, so then I was part of Ball Construction for 25 years.
Oh, wow.
So I worked for Gary Ball as a project manager, estimator, and started out, like you said, on small, easy projects, and then just kept climbing the ladder and getting more and more responsibility with bigger jobs, more complex jobs. And so I had a 25-year career at Ball, and some of my favorite projects that I look back on in my career. One of the first really challenging one was the Eagle River Bridge, where you take the Highland exit and you go
Yeah.
To Eagle River Loop.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
That bridge there crossing Eagle River Canyon was
right.
One of my really fun projects.
Wow.
Figuring it out. At that time, Ball hadn't done a whole lot of public work, but the private economy was really down in the 80s.
Okay.
And 80s. So we started to said, well, you know, we know about doing a lot of concrete work and building things. And,
sure.
You know, I'll go pick up the plans, figure it out.
Whoa.
And
that must have been a heck of a project.
Yeah. It's got these big, you know, W-shaped piers that go up, I forget what it was, like 8 stories, and then the bridge across. And it was on a curve and a super.
So right.
That even made it. Yeah, that really challenged my high school geography skills.
Yeah, I'll bet.
I don't mean geography. I mean mathematics skills.
Right, right. Yeah.
Geometry.
Geometry, yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And so...
They tore that down, too, by the way, and built a new bridge.
No, the one...
Oh, no, no, that's the main highway.
The
yeah,
down,
that's right.
The one down the main highway they tore down.
That's right.
He almost got that right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Well, that's cool, though. That's amazing.
So did that bridge, and then, and then one of the other really fun projects that I did was the Alyeska tram terminal.
Oh, nice.
And the and the fine dining, the Seven Glaciers
right.
restaurant, the skiers restaurant at the top.
How did you get stuff up there without the tram? I mean, obviously before the tram was built.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, how on earth did they do that?
Yeah, well, you know, that's another job that, you know, we just pick up the plans, and it was a lump sum bid, and we bid on the hotel and the tram terminals, and we didn't know if we were going to get either one. I think the hotel was about a $60 million project, and the tram terminals about 13, and we were bidding against, I forget all the bidders, but Hoffman, Kiewit, Ball.
Okay.
And... We ended up getting just the tram terminals.
Okay.
And the way we bid the job, and it fortunately worked out, we took those six-wheel drive, all-wheel drive Volvo trucks and fabricated a trailer hitch on them and,
right.
And had like a 40-foot flat trailer with a pinto hitch, put a pinto hitch on it. And there was a haul road.
Okay.
All the way up to the top.
Wow.
To the roundhouse, not to the
very top. Yeah, okay.
To where the restaurant is built.
Sure.
And so first thing in the spring, we took a D8 Cat to get the road open.
Sure.
And then as soon as we could, we started hauling materials up, staging it in the Day Lodge parking lot. And hauling it up with either the Volvo with the trailer, or putting, we fabricated a bed in the Volvo because it's going up at a steep angle
right.
to make it flatter
right.
so that the materials would be easier to strap down.
Right.
And then we also had a dozer. We used a D8 Cat that would pull a trailer too.
You gotcha.
Know? And so that's how we got the materials up. The way the men got to the job site was the old chair one.
Oh, man.
And so they kept the chair running.
Right.
And so on, I think, every third chair we left for personnel, and then we took and put, like, little platforms on the chair to haul up all the small materials.
Gotcha.
You know, you could put a... You could have put a few hundred pounds
sure.
of freight.
Whatever, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, I think they're like 6x6 pallet size on each two of the chairs, and then the personnel would go up, and that's how we got small materials up, the larger stuff up on the haul roof.
Man.
And then we made concrete up at the top. We set up a concrete plant with...
Wow.
And got the water from the lake up there in the bowl.
Nice, okay.
Piped the water down, hauled up all of the cement and aggregate on these, on the trucks and flatbeds like we talked about.
Man.
And to get all the materials up there. And then staged everything, so when the Hall Road was closed due mm-hmm. to snow, and I think we were able to go up until about the 1st of October.
Okay.
And then on the other side, the north face, where mm-hmm. the tram was coming up,
mm-hmm.
it was like our construction elevator. So we were able to get the tram terminal at the bottom belt, enough equipment up. So by, and you know, that's 25 years ago. I can't remember the exact time frame, but we got that, call it our construction elevator, operating
right.
to get the rest of the materials up. And there you
right.
could haul, you know, a lot bigger
right.
Trusses and wood. And so built the, you know, got the structure up for the most part and worked all through the winter.
Wow.
With the tram being our construction elevator.
Man.
And then we had one entire crew, and I forget how many was on that crew. It would vary, let's say 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
And their job was snow removal. Oh. And temporary heat and cover every day.
Oh, my God. Whoa.
In order to keep the project going and on schedule.
So I'm curious, did the road that you used to haul the materials up become some of the ski runs later on?
Is that what
we're skiing down when we go out there?
Yeah, if you go basically. Up. And they still use that road every summer.
Oh.
And that road was there, you know, when they built the resort.
I see.
So
oh, interesting.
You start up there on the where the Tanaka chair is,
yeah.
the ski racers trail over to the right. I don't even know if that chair lift's still there. But it's a switchback road
yeah,
that goes up
exactly.
there. And the hardest part, there's a little switchback around the waterfall.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, yes.
And then you continue on up the bowl.
Right, yep.
And then you know how you ski from the roundhouse down to
mm-hmm.
the bowl.
Right.
That's part of the Hall Road, too.
Okay,
coming
yeah.
up there. And
okay,
so you do
okay.
ski that road still today.
I'll be darned. Well, that's really cool.
And then down at the down at the bottom in that bowl area is where the drain field is.
Oh,
for the septic system for
oh,
the facility.
Nice to know.
And the well is up above. You know, we mm-hmm. had to drill a well to get water because
sure.
there wasn't adequate water for the, you know, the well that was there wasn't adequate enough. You know, it just served the roundhouse, and I don't even know if they had, they might have been hauling water.
Wow.
In the early stages.
Wow.
And so we ended up with drilling a well up on the side of the mountain, and you'd think, well, God, you had to go really deep to get water, but really the water table, if I remember, was only 200 or 300 feet.
Interesting.
Deep well, and it's adequate water, and it's served the whole top
wow.
resort for quite some time.
I'll be darned.
And, you know, so it's like building a house on the hillside, you know, you got your
yeah.
well and septic.
Sure. No, I guess so. I tell you, every time I ride up that tram and you get to the top and I look at that massive concrete structure, I'm like, how in the hell did they do this?
Yeah.
I've always wondered that. So I feel like I learned something today.
Yeah, what's cool is, you know, that's what I love. I have a passion for construction, and that's
right,
what I
man,
love about
too.
Being a builder is you can drive around and go.
So true.
I built that, you know,
yeah.
me and 100 other people.
Right.
And I was the project
right.
manager that figured it out. And,
that's so cool, though.
And my superintendent, too, who I enjoyed working with for many, many years. He and I had so much fun doing that project.
That's awesome. It is fun. Yeah. Hell, I'm just a taper, and I still tell people, I built that building. All I did was tape and paint a few walls.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, my girlfriend doesn't need to know all the details.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah, I was the project manager. I was
yeah.
the head guy.
That counts. That's actually
course,
something.
But
yeah.
of course, I had 100 support people.
No, yeah, that's cool, man. Any other fun projects?
And then after that project, yeah, this is another one. And the reason why I picked these out, because they're not, you know, we did lots of concrete tilled-up warehouses
mm-hmm.
and shopping centers and grocery stores and big box stores.
Sure.
And, you know, those are challenging, but they're not really fun projects.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so the next one after that was project came out to bid out at the airport, mm-hmm. Anchorage International. And you know the upper ramp for the arrival ramp,
yeah.
Ramp there.
Okay,
that whole elevated ramp was deteriorating and having lots of problems. So DOT put out a bid to take the entire concrete surface off of that ramp and put a silica-based concrete topping over it, take it down to just below the rebar. Let's say it's a 6-inch thick concrete slab. Take the top 2 or 3 inches off down to the rebar and redo it, and do a bunch of structural upgrades to the columns and everything else. It was a big concrete job,
right?
And also, a civil project. Mm-hmm. And that was another one where, me and my superintendent, we didn't know anything about hydroblasting, and that's using these hydroblasters that develop 10,000 PSI with just a little stream of water the size of your little finger.
Right, be careful, take your leg off.
And it would take off the concrete, leave the rebar. Rebar's 40,000 PSI strength, concrete's maybe 5,000-6,000, so you got a 10,000 PSI water jet, you're going to blow away the concrete
and
leave the rebar.
Damn.
And so did a bunch of research, learned about that, and what was really challenging is the schedule for the project was you could start September 4th, right after Labor Day, and you had to be finished a week before Thanksgiving.
Oh, man.
That's kind of the off-season for the airport.
Okay.
Those months.
Okay.
And so it was very, very tight schedule.
Yeah.
And the liquidated damages were $26,000 per day.
Oh, that's charming.
Yeah.
That's like a little pressure.
So every day that you are late, tack on $26,000.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that was probably one of the more challenging projects. And, but the bottom line, I'll back up. So we bid the job.
Right.
And, which I was the head estimator on, and we are $1 million low on
that'll make your toes curl.
Yeah. And so, this is 24 years ago. And so, it was only, a $4 million project.
Oh.
But when you're $1 million low.
My goodness, I didn't realize. Oh,
yeah,
geez.
20% low.
Yikes.
The second bidder was Wilder at the time.
Okay.
Now they're Granite.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember, there's only two bidders because, one.
Right.
No
Who
one
wants
had
that stress?
Any expertise or no outside bidders.
Uh-huh.
And I can say we had a really good estimate, but a poor bid.
Oh,
and
no.
A lot of contractors have been in that, situation. Well, I've double-checked and triple-checked everything. I think everything's covered, but we didn't assess, the risk and the competition and how they would view the job. And so I think... after Alyeska it was called, the project name was Revamp the Ramp.
Okay.
Project. I think Gary Baugh, he was starting to worry too much about these young guys bidding and doing work in his company, and soon after that he decided to retire, but I'll finish up on the Revamp the Ramp. And so what was interesting about the hydroblasting is that the ramp, the structural engineers thought you could just blow off the top, which worked for about, 50% of the ramp. But the other 50%, you blew right on through, totally, because it was that deteriorated.
Oh, no.
So now the scope of the work changed in order to have to form underneath the entire ramp and report.
Oh, boy.
And that was a change order because, you know, they thought the bottom concrete was sound enough. But
fair enough.
And so not only, you know, and the state was very fair about paying you for that change condition, but they weren't able to give you any more time.
Oh, no.
Because they still had to have that ramp open by Thanksgiving.
Let me guess, they didn't change their liquidated damages either.
No. So we ended up, and we had bid the job to work 20 hours a day, two shifts, and then the 4 hours would be for maintenance and retooling and everything else. And anyway, when that happened, we just had to increase the crew to do the forming of the ramp underneath and everything else going on.
Holy smokes.
We completed the project on time, you know, no liquidated damages.
Nice.
I mean, there was no, right up to the day.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Everyone was able to drive up and, travel for Thanksgiving.
Bam. Wow.
And so that was another one of my really interesting and fun projects.
It's an exciting 2 months.
Yeah. And so after that, Gary Baugh, who was in his mid to late 50s, he had been in the business since he was a kid. He just decided that he was going to wind down operations and enjoy his retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was, to make a long story short, as he, so I had three choices at the time when I found out he was going to wind down operations and go out of business. He didn't want to, I had always thought, well, maybe he'll want to sell the business to his key employees.
Right.
And that was always my hope. But, even in doing that, you end up still having a lot of risk until the company is fully bought out by the new employees, and you have risk for all of the projects that you've done over the last 25 years. And so he made the decision he's just going to wind down operations over a couple of years and retire. And so at the time, I had three choices, I felt like. At this time, I was married and had two young children. And I said, here are the choices for Dad. I've always wanted to have my own business. We can take our life savings, and which was only, I think, about $100,000 cash. That's what it takes to start a business is cash. He said this other stuff, is that's as much as we could come up with. We can take our life savings, which would be the kids' college education. I think my son was only 10. Let's see. He was born in 85, started my business in 95. So, yeah, he was about 10. My daughter was... it's got to be earlier than that. Anyway, I'm terrible on years and things. They all kind of all run together.
You just need to remember the day of the year.
Yeah.
I don't need to know exactly how old they are.
So first choice is start my own business because I've always wanted to do that. Second choice was go to work for another, general contractor in Anchorage because I was fairly well known and I could get a job at any of the other, any of my competitors. Third option, because my wife was kind of getting tired of Alaska and the cold and the long winters, and we could liquidate everything, move outside, and I could go to work for any other construction company. That's the beauty of our industry.
Sure.
With your skills, you can work anywhere in the world.
Sure.
There's construction, and the techniques are similar all over.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife said, if you don't do option number one, start your own business, you're going to be kicking yourself for the rest of your life. Why didn't I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out. It couldn't have worked out better because as Ball Construction wound down, I was able to pick up the guys that I'd worked with for 20 and 25 years together.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So I started my own business right in my basement of my house, started bidding work. Most of it, well, all of it, private. I had bonding for like a few hundred thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And I did bid a couple of design build jobs for the state, the Anchorage Pioneer Home, Palmer Pioneer Home. They're like $300,000 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's hardly any competition. Nobody at that point wanted a, you know, a $300,000 design build project for the state. And I did some work at Providence. So, you know, I got my first jobs and small jobs, and I hired my superintendent that I'd worked with for 25 years, built the three fun projects I talked about.
Right.
The bridge, Alyeska tram terminals, revamped the ramp, Mark Pollock. So he was my first employee.
Nice.
And he had already been laid off from Baugh, and it was February, you know, which, and so I said, hey, Mark, I'm going to start construction company. You want to be my first employee? And he thought, oh, this is so risky, you know.
You're
I don't
right.
know if he'll be able to pay me. And so Mark was my first employee, and then my current wife, I had gotten a divorce after having my company for 10 years and the kids were out of college. And my second wife right now, Karen, she was my second employee.
Oh, nice.
So there are three of us in the company. And Karen and I had worked together. I had hired her on the Alyeska tram terminals as a project management assistant. She had worked for Lise Cassie for 10 years. She was the most qualified person, even though she was one of the few females in construction.
Mm-hmm.
So we started out with Mark Pollock and Karen as being, you know, project management assistant, payroll, accounting, Girl Friday. And then we were very fortunate because we really didn't add to the competition in the marketplace. Because I knew the market and all the subs for the work that Baugh Construction had been doing for 25 years. So
sure.
As he wound down, I was able to grow the business and pick up the, you know, my best friends and coworkers that I'd worked for 20 years. And so as I was able to gradually grow and he wound down, I had my nucleus of people.
Sure.
And to fast forward, Mike Pollock, Mark's brother, Mike was one of my early superintendents at Baugh, and he is just retiring this week.
Oh, no
kidding.
He's
72.
Oh, wow.
And he and I have worked together for 45 years.
Wow.
And his brother, Mark, who retired a few years ago, he and I worked together for 40 some years, and so it's great to have that good group of friends, and they helped to make our company successful.
That's really neat.
Yeah, and so I am and always have been the sole owner of mm-hmm. Roger Hickel Contracting. But in the first year when I started the business, we formed another company, an equipment company.
Hmm.
It's called Construction Equipment Supply Company, CESC.
Oh, okay.
And that all of the, we do a lot of heavy civil work and building work, and so all of the heavy equipment that the construction company uses, they rent from Construction Equipment Supply Company.
Nice, smart.
Construction Equipment Supply Company is owned by the employees.
Oh, that's really
cool.
So
it's a you know, I feel like even though the employees were, the key employees were not owners of the construction company, they were owners of the equipment company, and the equipment company has done very well. It's averaged rates of return as high as anywhere from 10 to 25%.
Good.
And we have over, I don't even know how many, 200 pieces of major equipment valued
wow.
at over $3.5 million.
So, holy smokes.
So the equipment company has grown, as has the employees' net worth in the equipment
return,
company.
Yeah.
So,
good.
So that's how, you know, the employees, if the construction company does well, gets a big project, it's going to rent lots of equipment, they're going to do well.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. That's neat.
Yeah. So we have two companies, and we do rent very seldom to other generals, but, you know, they're not going to rent from their competitors, but
sure.
we rent to some equipment to outside entities,
right.
but most of it's all in-house.
That's cool.
So that's kind of, you know, to back up then to the start of RHC, Roger Hickel Contracting, we just, you know, I guess our history is similar to my history as a project manager. You know, you
right.
start off with smaller jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You retain all the earnings you can, so you get a little more bonding,
mm-hmm.
and you keep growing so that you can get to the larger projects.
That's awesome.
So that kind of takes us up to, well, I guess I will also add that, you know, my timing couldn't have been better. You know, the economy has been great for the last, been in business 22 years, and the economy's been great for 21 years. You know, just,
sure.
We had some slow times and some stressful times, but, you know, nothing like it's been this last year.
Yeah.
And so it's the Alaska economy, like everyone knows, is really challenged right now.
Mm-hmm.
And as Roger Hickel Contracting, you know, part of my business plan, which was fairly similar to Baugh's in that, you know, I learned through being at Baugh that I never wanted Roger Hickel Contracting to get involved in a joint venture project, because we did one at Baugh and our joint venture partner was very weak and went bankrupt, and
yikes,
we had two of those. And so I said, nah, I don't think I ever want to work as a joint venture. Also, never wanted to work as a subcontractor,
mm-hmm.
you know, just stick to what you know, be a general contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And the third item in my plan was don't work outside of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And then also don't work for the Corps of Engineers, because I didn't have any experience with the Corps. And it takes a different type of organization. You know, it takes more personnel to do a Corps job. Everybody knows that. If, you know, on a private job, you can have a project manager and a superintendent, and very minimal general conditions take that exact same project for the Corps, and you got to have five people doing the same.
Hmm.
Because of all the paperwork and the requirements. And so that was part of my plan also. Well, as RHC continued to grow and prosper, we were approached to do a joint venture. And looked hard on that, and basically it turned out to be a great experience. We joint ventured with Great Northwest and did a big project up on the Dalton Highway.
Okay.
And that turned out to be a great experience. We have great friends now at Great Northwest out of Fairbanks.
Nice.
So that early decision not to do that, well, worked out great.
That's good.
Next one was don't work as a subcontractor.
Yeah.
Well, we ended up working at the Chugach Electric Power Plant. MLNP power plant.
Oh, right.
And the Matanuska
MEA
electric power plant.
Mm-hmm.
All a subcontract doing what we do best, underground utilities, earthwork, and concrete work, and they were the generals.
Right.
So in each case, I won't name the generals, but they're all large generals from outside.
Right.
And they needed a local general contractor that knew how to do the type of work. You know, none of those do much self-perform work.
Right.
And so we ended up doing, I'd say anywhere from, I'll just say an average of about 30 to 40 million mm-hmm. on each project as a sub.
Right, yeah.
And the type of work we love, you know, and after having that experience, I says, God, it's great being a sub. You don't have to, you don't have to worry about all the things generals have to do. You just go in and do your own work.
Right, yeah.
And so so my decision, early decision, don't work as a sub, turned out to be wrong. And we did very well working as a sub on to the big outside generals.
Right.
And then the third decision, which was not work outside of Alaska, well, that turned out to here about a year and a half ago, seeing that there's not going to be enough work in Alaska to keep us going, we started bidding work in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And we bid about four projects, and we've done a lot of school work here in Alaska. We built, you know, Begich Middle School, which is a $40 million school. And so we decided there's lots of school work in Seattle that we'd start bidding school work. It's something we know. And so we bid four or five projects and then finally got one at Lake Stevens School District, which is about an hour north of Seattle. So we're in the process of building a $40 million school.
I'll be darned.
At Lake Stevens, Washington. But I will say that that's a decision that I'm starting to regret. learning new subs, new market, no available labor.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
That has been a problem. And we've learned a lot, but we've paid for this education.
Interesting.
We'll probably continue to pursue work down there until Alaska's economy gets better, because there's just not enough work to support our organization here.
Yeah,
we want to keep all of our young key personnel and field people working. So we sent a crew down there, and what we didn't realize is that there's so much work down there that the subs can't perform their work. We had two subs that went broke.
Ay.
And that cost us a bunch. And we thought we could self-perform the work we typically self-perform. But when we went to put crews together, there were no crews. Mm-hmm. The halls were empty.
Right.
The available labor was unskilled, not qualified.
Right.
And so we ended up having to sub work that we thought we could self-perform, and the subs didn't perform. So
what a pain.
It's been a nightmare, but So I say, I was 2 out of 3 on my good decisions, one didn't turn out as well. But we'll be finished with it's two buildings, an early learning center that we turned over here few weeks ago, and then the elementary school, which will turn over in March. And it's a beautiful school, proud of it.
Right.
You know, it looks great. People don't know whether you lost money, made money, or what.
Right.
And we'll try again down there if we can't get enough work in Alaska.
Right.
And the available work here goes to my number four rule, working for the Corps of Engineers.
Right, I was going to ask
about
that.
They have a lot of work available, but I don't know if I want to break into that market.
Oh, man. Right.
And it's very hard to break in that market. I guess I'll get my 2 cents in on that. You know,
mm-hmm.
the federal government and the Corps, Department of Defense, they have so much work that's RFP,
mm-hmm.
Request for Proposals, mm-hmm. and to break into that market, you know, there's the technical part of the proposal and the pricing part.
Mm-hmm.
And the technical part requires, one of the questions, let's say you get 100 points for the technical part, and maybe 20 points is how many jobs have you done for the Corps of Engineer, you know, over $10 million if you're bidding on a job, you know, that's $15
million. Sure.
And if you get zero on that criteria, you're already at a 20% disadvantage. So
right.
What happens is the, you know, my competitors, the Cornerstone, Davis, Neisser, you know, that Watterson, those mm-hmm. group of companies have had a lot of core experience. So
sure.
It's hard to break into that club.
Right.
And so unless it's a lump sum bid, you know, we don't feel like we have a chance of getting work for the core.
Interesting.
And because most of their projects are RFP.
Right.
So that's why we're forced to look for work in
out of state
and other markets. So I'd say 2018 was one of our toughest years in business. And I mean 2017, and I predict 2018 will probably be similar.
Yeah.
Hopefully the national economy and what our current Congress and administration is doing will help Alaska, and we'll start recovering in 2019.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, what you saw in the, you know, future. I mean, not that your crystal ball is any shinier than anyone else's, but as far as our state economy and construction specifically, any insights or thoughts on where we might be going or what might be a light at the end of the tunnel? Hopefully not a train, but anything you want to share, any thoughts? Or,
you know, like you said, my crystal ball is probably not as good as the rest of the people here in Alaska. If I had a good crystal ball, you know, you'd never leave any money on the table on these lump
right.
sum bids.
That $1 million on the ramp would have been yeah. closer to $100.
Yeah. And, so, you know, I guess I've lived in Alaska full time since 1973 after I graduated from college. I love the state. It's a can-do state. We'll figure out how to get through these tough economic times like we have in the, you know, lots of times in Alaska,
sure.
in the 80s. And I think it's still the greatest state for opportunity for young people.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I have an opportunity to talk to people outside, like I said, I have 5 brothers and 14 nieces and nephews, and I still tell them, you know, this is still the land of opportunity. You know, when I compare my living in Alaska to, I have 2 brothers in California and 2 in the Seattle area and 1 in Phoenix, and seeing my nieces and nephews trying to, you know, afford to buy a house and just make it on their salaries, I still think Alaska is still the place to be in the future, and we'll get through these harder economic times, and we'll be back to booming again. It's still a beautiful place to live.
Oh yeah.
As you know, whenever you're traveling outside or around the world, as soon as you say you're from Alaska, you get a crowd around you.
Instant celebrity.
The instant celebrity. That's a good term. Everybody wants to know about Alaska. How'd you get there? How come you've stayed so long?
Can you see Russia?
all that stuff. Yeah.
No, I'm with you on that. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I don't have any plans to go anywhere. I've had opportunities afforded me that I don't know that would have been afforded elsewhere. It's kind of funny from my perspective. You know, I started my apprenticeship in the union in 2001, and so this current economic downturn is basically like the first one of my career, like mm-hmm. my whole adult life. Me and my peers, anybody, you know, roughly my age, I'm 35, you know, and so it's a little scary. You know, I'll be honest with you. A lot of guys I know have moved or taken their families down south, Seattle, Portland, whatever. But if you look back at history, you're right. It usually you know, ebbs and flows. It should come back around. I mean, there's always talk of some sort of mega project, a gas line or something. Whatever. That would be handy. But even if that doesn't happen, you know, I am still eternally optimistic. It'll turn around. And heck, I mean, who are we kidding? There's nowhere else I'd rather live. There's nowhere else I'd rather be. I'll stick it out however I have to do it. This is a beautiful place and glad to call it home.
Yeah, I love it here, but I will have to interject after 45 winters. I have missed the last four or five.
Well, that's the way to do it, is to snowbird and go
somewhere.
But
that's because I can work remote now because... Nice. I guess 6 years ago, I turned over the day-to-day operation to my trusted key employees. And so, you know, I don't do the day-to-day battles anymore.
Gotcha.
I just take care of the fun things, you know.
Right.
Cash flow, bonding, insurance, right. Reviewing bids from my, which is funny, either from my deck in Alaska... Mm-hmm. My lanai in
there you go
in Maui.
Now you're talking.
Or my patio in Arizona. You know,
perfect.
They're all the same. They just call them something different. Yeah, you know, right. So I can log on to our server at the office and talk to the estimator and review estimates and
perfect.
Work a few hours in the morning and then go and enjoy the hobbies that
good.
I love.
Well earned and well deserved. That's cool.
One personal note, you know, growing up here in Alaska as an adult, you know, I was always into basketball because that's something you can play all winter long and
right.
Played in all of the sports and played on all of the different levels, you know, started out in the open league and then the over 30 and the over 40 and the over 50. And so when I turned 60, I'm 67 right now, and said, okay, I'm going to play hard from 60 to 70 and then go back to work. And part of the reason that I saw my dad die at 65, he worked right up until the day he died of prostate cancer. And I said, you know, I need to have some fun. I've worked, and I tell people I worked 60 years in 40. And you being in construction, mm-hmm. you would understand
sure.
that. You know, when you work six tens
for
40 years, you know, that's the same as working 60 years in 40 years. And I said,
right.
So you know, they say, you can't retire at 60. And I said, yeah, I've been working for 60 years, which is, you know, six tens for 40 years, and I'm going to play hard from 60 to 70, and then if I need to, I'll go back to work at 70.
Right.
You
there
know,
you go.
And then it's easier just to, you know, sit in the office because you can't do all those fun things you like doing.
Mm-hmm.
So at 60, for all of the golfers that are listening, I decided, well, that sport can't be that hard, you know.
Man.
the ball's not moving, the pin's not moving, it looks so easy.
Right.
So I decided to take up the game of golf, and I had no idea how time-consuming it would be.
Oh, man.
How expensive it can be. And how long it takes.
And how much patience it takes.
Good at it. So... that's been my passion for the last 6 years, is learning how to play golf.
That's cool.
And I've got a lot of time invested in it,
mm-hmm.
a few lessons. But I started off, you know, not knowing anything about it and not even how to swing the club or grip the club. And so
sure.
I started off with lessons. And so I've enjoyed that as
awesome.
As my sport I saved for my retirement.
I like that.
And I figure that's... I had a 94-year-old stepdad who he passed away a few years ago, and he kind of got me into it. And he, you know, pointed out that you can play this game forever.
Yeah.
And he also shot his age from the time he was like 68 until he was 84. So he was a good golfer, and that was. When he passed away, we were going through he kept his scorecards from when he shot 68 when he was 68, which is, you know, four under.
That's impressive.
And when he shot 69 and 70 and 71 all the way up, he had every card that he had until he was like 80-something.
That's really cool.
So, I've got my handicap down to just under 12.
Wow.
After 5 years. So
that's...
But,
that's
of
impressive.
Course, I played 80 times last year and about 80 times the year before. So,
right.
Yeah.
Practice.
So my advice is don't take up that sport when you're young and trying to make
right.
a living.
Unless you can play 80 times a year.
Because it takes a lot of time and money and patience.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, it's good. Good
so
advice.
So that's something on a personal note in my, and I don't say I'm semi-retired. I say I'm semi-working.
Nice.
It sounds a lot better than semi-retired, doesn't it?
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
But during these challenging times, I'll have to say I have worked a few more hours than I wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, when I was 60, I was still averaging, you know, 3,000 hours a year. And I said, okay, I'm going to start this program, and my goal for the next year is 2,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The next year, 1,000 hours.
Yeah.
The next year, 500 hours. And I'd say I probably got it down to about 750 hours of work a year. Maybe down to 500, and then when the economic climate changed here in Alaska, I'd probably back up to 750 hours.
Yeah.
But I still have a great life. And,
seems fair, yeah.
And Alaska's been so good to me. And to my family and my kids, I had two children, and my second wife has one daughter, and they're both 36.
Oh, wow.
And they're lifetime Alaskans, born and raised here, not leaving.
Yeah.
My wife's daughter, Ashley, lives in Eagle River. My daughter lives in Girdwood. She's a highly educated ski coach.
Nice.
And a ski instructor and a full-time mom. Both of them are full-time moms.
Outstanding.
And then my son is working in the business, and he's 35. No, let's see. I got to get this straight. I guess he's only 32.
What's his name?
Sean.
Yeah, Sean. I know Sean.
Do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. He's a great guy. We worked together on a little the Construction Leadership Council here
oh,
at
yeah.
AGC.
Yeah,
yeah, he's a really nice guy.
So he's been working in the business, you know, as a laborer going through college.
Nice,
and,
yeah.
And as a project engineer, and now he's, and then he went, I might have burned him out a little bit when he was, you know, in his late 20s. He was working on the power plant in at MEA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was working 6-10s plus the, you know, 45-minute commute each
right.
way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He says, Dad, I have no life.
Right.
And I says, I know what you mean, son. That's yeah. the way my life was.
Welcome to the family business.
For many years, you know.
Right.
When you were growing up and I was working at Ball Construction 60 hours a week.
Yeah,
and,
man.
And had all sorts of stress and pressure. I said, yeah, you're not telling me anything I don't know. So then he decided, you know, he wanted to go in, work full-time in the office and in the accounting department because that's a 40-hour-a-week job. And he did
yeah.
that for a couple of years. And he says, you know, this is just boring. And
right.
So now he's back into project right. management and enjoying it. And I'm hoping that in a couple of years I'll be turning over the business to my son and another key employee at
nice.
Roger Hickel Contracting, Scott Dunlap, and I think the two of them will be able to keep the company going for another 20-30 years. You know, and I saw what happened to Ball Construction, you know, as
mm-hmm.
he decided to wind down and go out of business, and that's
mm-hmm.
you know, that's an option.
Yeah.
Or you know, have the business continue on, and with I have a great group of young professionals, and you know they have fun together. They
right.
enjoy. They have a passion for construction, and so
mm-hmm.
I want them to continue on. So hopefully, my goal is here in 3 years that I'm no longer semi-working, that I'm retired.
Fair enough.
At 70, so that's my goal. And it'll be fun to watch the next generation succeed and have fun at it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I look forward to working with your son, being part of that next generation in the next few decades here in the state, for sure.
Great.
I've been trying to lean on him to bring him in for an interview, get his experience coming up through the trade, so you have to tell him.
Yeah, he had a similar, you know, except for he didn't, you know, when he was growing up, you know, I'd be building a playhouse or doing on this and that, and he just wasn't as interested, you know.
Right.
He didn't enjoy it, and I think that's at the time, you know, he wanted to be out playing with his buddies and biking and doing all that. But I think now he's starting to get the builder's
the bug.
Gene and wanting to carry on.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's. I don't know where you want to go from here.
No, I just wanted to say thank you. That's where I want to go from here. I appreciate your time coming in this morning, and Chad, it's been a pleasure to get to know you, and I appreciate you sharing some of your experiences and, you know, how you've come up through the trades here in Alaska, and looking forward to the future. I mean, like I said, eternally optimistic, and I think we're going to be just fine.
Great. Thanks, Bronson. Yeah. It's been fun telling my life story. This is about the first time I've done this.
Right on. Well, it was great. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.